everyone. Welcome to Garden Fork Radio. You're here with Rick and Eric.
Good morning, Eric. Happy New Year, my friend.
Happy New Year to you, too. Happy New Year, everyone. Thanks for dialing in or downloading. Appreciate you taking the time to listen to Garden Fork. Today we have a kind of a, I'm trying to be more topic oriented, and Rick sent me a link to a magazine, an online magazine I find really cool. It's called Low Tech Magazine. We're going to be talking about what are called fruit walls, which were this urban farming technique that started out in the 1600s. But more in general, this online website called lowtechmagazine.com talks about, I'll just read you the about page. It says, Low Tech Magazine refused to assume that every problem has a high-tech solution. A simple, sensible, but nevertheless controversial message. High-tech has become the idol of our society. Instead, Low Tech Magazine talks about the potential of past and often forgotten knowledge and technologies when it comes to designing a sustainable society. Sometimes these low-tech solutions could be copied without any changes. More often, interesting possibilities arise when you combine old technology with new knowledge and new materials, or when you apply old concepts and traditional knowledge to modern technology. We also keep an eye on what is happening in the developing world, where resource constraints often lead to inventive low-tech solutions. It's written by a guy named Chris De Becker, who lives in Barcelona, and it's proofread by a person, Deva, who lives in South Africa and South Korea.
And it's really a brilliant concept. Of course, it plays right into my I'm not quite a survivalist, but I do kind of have that tendencies toward that. You can see how things could go off the rails, and even for a short period of time, we might have to fend for ourselves. Of course, the most likely option would be some sort of a coronal mass ejection, a sun flare that not too long ago took out some power grid up in the far northwest in Canada. We might have to make do for a while with what we have on hand, which is the reason that as much as I love reading, and I read on my iPad all the time, books, I read Kindle books on it. All of my reference books are hardbacks, my Rodell's Organic Gardening Encyclopedia, all my health books and how to care for dogs, that kind of thing, are all here in hardback just in case.
I like it just because I'm fascinated by stuff that's often forgotten. And a lot of the older inventions were made out of wood, and it was before the era of photography everywhere. And they are forgotten because they weren't documented really well. There might be some line drawings or something in an old book. But there's this stuff that's there, like these human-powered cranes that they have, they write about in Low Tech Magazine, that were powered by two people on these treadmills and using a series of pulleys and cables would be like an excavator, could function like an excavator or a crane or a hoist. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. Ways to lift water for water wells, just almost anything you can think of. There have been low-tech solutions that apply the principles of the inclined plane and all the different techniques that the ancients discovered to make life a little bit easier for people. And it's amazing to see that stuff kind of coming back and the knowledge captured and presented here. But this guy writes amazing articles, and they just they're thoroughly annotated, lots of pictures, and it's very well researched. I mean, this guy's like research quality, university quality research.
Yeah, so he doesn't post every day. It's a couple times a month, but when a post comes out, it's pages long and it's really well researched. So, well, let's talk about fruit walls. Rick, do you want to summarize what they are?
Well, sure. Essentially, and if you've been to Europe, and particularly to parts of Paris and then other parts of London, you'll notice that there are just these enormous high walls everywhere. And you're like, man, these people are kind of, paranoid. But the truth is, they're probably, and particularly in this one area of France, of Paris, these were tall, thick walls made to absorb the heat of the sun, cut the wind, and allow them to grow fruit inside the walls, creating really just a microclimate inside. And they were able to grow, and this is in the 1500s, 1600s, grow Mediterranean fruit all year long, or at least keep it going all year long, as far north as Belgium. Belgium and in some of those places. So, you know, it's really amazing to see this work out.
Yeah, they said that they could grow figs and currants and peaches. And if you have ever seen, you've gone to a nursery and seen what's called an espaliered fruit tree, where it's trained to grow along a wall and the branches go horizontally, and they have grafted different fruits onto them. That is the key to the fruit wall concept. They're training a plant to grow along a wall that soaks up solar energy and then gives that heat back on cooler days and in the evening to keep that fruiting plant growing in an area where it might not grow normally. But they've trained it to grow out like that.
Yeah, I always thought that the espalier technique was just decorative. I had no idea it was really to spread the foliage out horizontally along a wall so that you could let it radiate the heat and capture all the possible heat and sun that it could. So I was quite fascinated.
Yeah, Rick, you did all the annotations, so you should take the lead on this, because I'll just ramble.
Well, let me see. When you do the espalier, one of the things that's really important is you don't actually have the fruit tree up against the wall. You have some space behind it and a standoff, usually something wooden, so you can have lots of good circulation behind it. And there were some areas that were so full of these walls, they'd probably be no bigger than a house today, this area that was inside the walls. And they'd be maybe 10 or 12 foot high, up to about 6 foot thick. So they'd really absorb, and they're masonry walls, so they'd absorb lots of heat. And they would completely enclose this little courtyard, and they would have fruit trees on the sides that got the best south sun. And then they would have more hardy plants in the center away from the walls. But they were essentially creating a microclimate, and they would be able to raise the temperature inside of these between 18 and 20 degrees. From the ambient air outside. And it was enough so that even in the middle of winter, delicate fruits would be able to survive the winter. And if not produce fruit, they'd be able to make it so they keep going next year. So that was kind of the whole idea of it.
They have a very interesting picture through Google Maps of the town of Thomery in France, showing these fruit walls as they exist today. And there are houses built among the fruit walls, but it's just a wild picture.
Yeah. And it was such a, it was like a maze, a rat in a maze. And it was so terrible back in there that when the Prussians invaded in 1870 in Paris, they actually just avoided that part of town completely because they couldn't figure it out. So there was kind of a benefit to it. And then it moved on down south and kind of southeast of there and took a different form. Now, these fruit walls eventually, I guess I should go back a little bit, got really sophisticated, and they started building them with chimneys that would run horizontally back and forth through the walls, and they would burn wood or coal and heat the walls from the inside.
I thought that was interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And then even later they started using pipes and water and running hot water through the walls to raise the temperature. And so that was, that was interesting. It wasn't particularly efficient. This is a period when wood and labor were extremely cheap, though.
Yes, like today.
But then down in Tomory, which is about 50 miles southeast of Paris, they started using grapes. And instead of building a enclosed garden, a walled garden, what they did was built long linear walls, and they would I'm waving my hands around. Did you hear that?
Yes, we did.
They built long walls, and they would put the espalier the grapes up onto the walls with an overhang to protect them from the snow and whatnot. And then in front of the walls, they'd build a knee wall that was about 3 foot high that would actually reflect the heat back. The main wall radiated heat out, it would catch some of that heat and reflect it back. And so it was just a different kind of trying to use solar energy. We think of it as the Trombe effect, actually, T-R-O-M-B-E, Trombe walls, just absorbing heat and then releasing it at night or during the when it's cold.
Yeah, I knew that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the Dutch got into it, and they actually improved this. Instead of straight walls, they started making theirs if you look down from the top, it looks like corrugation, like, you know, they weave back and forth. And that actually made them stronger using less material. And so they kind of were a serpentine-looking wall. And that allowed them to build it only one or two bricks thick. But and so they saved on material, even though they covered more territory using
that.
Right,
so they didn't have as massive of a wall, but they could make a longer wall that way.
Right. And, you know, and this went all the way up to 53 degrees north. And so that's way up there that they could do this. So it worked out for them.
Truth be told, I mean, the northern climes of North America actually get colder than the same, is it a longitude, in Europe because of the way the trade winds blow.
Yeah, latitude.
Latitude, sorry, Mr. Sailor.
No, it's all right.
What I thought was cool was when
you asked.
Yeah. They went a step farther with the fruit walls, and they laid essentially an old storm window at an angle over the fruit wall and started to create the first greenhouses.
Right.
And I thought that was like, oh, well, here we go. And then I wondered why we don't use these fruit walls now, because they said in the 1900s, they started moving to straight greenhouses because the technology to make plate glass, large pieces of glass, had improved to the point. And they abandoned the fruit walls and they would just build these giant greenhouses that were very heat inefficient, but I guess coal and then oil were so cheap back then that they could just burn a bunch of coal and run a furnace and heat a big glass greenhouse.
I guess so. And they really didn't care about the amount of pollution and stuff they were putting out into the air. But for smaller operations, they used these little hand-blown cloches. They yep. look like a bell jar. With the open bottom and a little individual greenhouse for your plants. And then that's kind of where you and I and most of the listeners are involved at kind of this level, because that's something we could actually do, protecting individual plants or making a small greenhouse like your small portable greenhouse you built.
Oh, yeah, our little mini greenhouses, which there'll be some videos coming out about that, actually.
Oh, mine is working beautifully, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, our modern-day cloche is basically a plastic gallon milk jug with the bottom cut out, you know?
Right. Yeah, see, that works. But this was imported to the United States. Thomas Jefferson, if you go and visit Monticello, and you're over on the garden sides where his that little shack, or not a shack, a little portico that he built where he could sit and write and watch the gardens and whatnot, is sitting on top of a 15-foot-high wall that he built to absorb the heat from the sun on the south side during the winter and then project that heat out toward his orchard. And so he was always trying to grow grapes, and he wasn't particularly good at it, but just couldn't get the right varieties going. But if you you look at his designs, he purposely put his fruits trees down there so that they would catch this radiated heat from this big wall to have their own little microclimate. But it's a part of the estate not many people get to see because they don't go down into the orchard side. They're up on top of the wall looking at the gardens.
They said at the end of this article that in China, they are building more and more of these passive solar greenhouses so that they have a brick, some sort of mass wall on one side, and then it's like half a greenhouse built onto it. And there's a bunch of pictures in a second article on the site talking about that. And that's just kind of brilliantly simple.
Right. But did you notice this one footnote here that glass greenhouses were invented by the Romans in the second century, but that we had lost the technology?
Yeah, well, that was my point at the beginning of the show, was just, you know, this kind of lost stuff. Like the Romans made amazing concrete.
Oh yeah, the Parthenon in Rome, largest freeform concrete dome in the world. Actually, the largest freeform piece of concrete anywhere in the world. And they mixed it, and it's still up there. Yeah, it's an amazing piece of engineering.
And then half the concrete, well, at least in New York City, half the concrete they pour falls apart in a couple of years, you know? So there might be some nefarious going on there in the mixing of the concrete. So
well, and you know, I was reading an article the other day, and they said most earthquake deaths in, you know, Turkey and Haiti and China are not earthquake failures. They're concrete failures. They're concrete disasters because they are skimping on the important parts of the concrete, and that the houses should actually hold up to most of the timbers. And that if you'll notice who owns the concrete companies in some of these places, they're some of the most prominent people in the country. So, not saying anything. Just noticing.
So well, it got me thinking about taking one of my cold frames. You know, I had built a wooden cold frame with a storm window. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I wonder if I could build like a thermal heat trap against the back wall of that with bricks or something. You know, could I site it on, I put it on a garden bed and then open the window and stack a bunch of brick on the back wall of the cold frame, you know, has a window that's tilted toward the sun. And I was just curious about that. What do you think?
Sure. It should work. I can't imagine it'd be an easy project to try and see. If you ever come down to Colonial Williamsburg and go through their gardens, they have a lot of this on display there, both the bell glass cloches and things like the trum walls with just a frame leaning up against them, and hotbeds, which you could do if you have anybody that has horses up there around you in Connecticut.
Or cows.
Yeah, or cows, but horses are better, uh-huh. I understand. They dig out a bed about 6 foot deep, line it with bricks, and they fill it 4 foot deep with horse manure, put hay on top of it. It doesn't have to be pure horse manure. It can be mixed with whatever you get out of the stable, hay and whatnot. Hay on top of it, and then a nice thick layer of soil, and then they plant their seedlings in that and put a pane of glass over the top of it, a window pane. And that hotbed will germinate lettuce and all kinds of plants all winter long. And you have to be very careful to make sure that it's aerated, because you can really overheat something like that. But it was a tried and true technique.
Huh.
And like I said, I know there's over at the Naval Station Oceana, Naval Air Station, there's a riding stable, and I've been half threatening to go get a a few gallons of horse manure and give this a try.
Yeah, what the heck? So how's your mini greenhouse going?
It is remarkable. I can't thank you so much for that.
I didn't invent it, so.
Well, but I need to post my pictures of my little tweaks to it. But and it was just so I can take it apart and put it up against the fence. That's the only real difference, a little more easily, because I don't have as much room as you do.
Yep.
But it was 24 the other day outside. Everything's, of course, kind of frozen, except when I look at my mini greenhouse, there's water on the inside running down the inside condensing. And so it's at least well above freezing inside there. And my little louvers for the automatic louvered vents are closed. And it was just in there, just as happy as it could be. And when I, on nice days, when I open it up and weed a little bit inside and whatnot, all my plants in there, I have two of them now, and all my plants in there are just growing like crazy.
Yeah, it's been so warm in New England here, I keep on thinking I should start my garden, you know?
Yeah. It's been a real problem for us. It's been a problem for beekeepers. I know people get a little annoyed when we talk too much about bees, but our bees are flying and there's nothing for them to bring in. And so they're burning through their honey and everybody's feeding like crazy right now. And we're really afraid that the queen is laying. In fact, when you crack, some people have already reported they're cracking open the hive. They're finding the queen down laying in the lower brood chambers. And, one day pretty soon we're going to have a real cold snap and bees are cold blooded.
They don't like cold.
And so as it gets colder, they get slower and she's not going to be able to climb back up onto the honey. And we'll probably lose the hives that way. And so it's going to be a disastrous February, I think.
Okay, well, on that note.
Yeah, isn't that a downer?
We have a neat article by one of our Patreon contributors, Scott, who has been on the show. He's an agronomist up in Canada, does a bunch of very interesting things in his yard. And he writes articles on Medium, which is pretty cool. That's like a big wheel, super giant blog website. And he's written about turning the compost. And Rick found this article and alerted me to it. So thanks, Rick.
You bet. And he goes by Cowboy Junkie, Scott does. But he has regular posts up there on Medium. And you can just kind of follow along with his trials of how he's doing things in his really cold climate up there. And he's a good writer, he's a good photographer, and he does a lot of great stuff.
Yeah, and it's just I also like the Medium site is very clean. So it also looks like he's using some pallets here in a compost bin, which is yay.
Yay. I helped a friend of mine the last fall build compost bins with pallets, and she's enjoying it quite a bit.
It's interesting, in this one picture here, he has a larger compost bin, and then he has a smaller amount of compost that's being held in a section by, looks like, pieces of scrap plywood with just stakes drilled into the ground. That's very smart, instead of just letting it kind of splay all over the place.
Yeah. Well, you got to keep that mass up so that you can keep the organisms, particularly up that high, that far north, so you can kind of keep a thermal mass going a little bit. But he really has some great looking compost there.
Really nice. And then he has some wooden stakes here that are painted green and purple. We're going to have to ask him about that. What's with that?
We'll find out. Maybe he'll call us.
Neat. So that's on medium.com. We will link to it in the show notes here. It's at cowboy, medium.com/@cowboyjunkie. And you'll find all of Scott's articles there. Very smart guy. Very smart plant guy there.
Yep. And good friend to Garden Fork Radio.
Yeah.
Well, anything new on the video front?
Yeah, we have two videos out about making I don't really want to call it a vegetarian chili. I would call it a vegetable chili.
I think that's a better way to say it, yeah.
I think vegetarian turns people off, even though I basically I'm vegetarian during the week, and then we have some meat on the weekends. But I got the idea of using butternut squash in a vegetable chili from Martha Rose Shulman of the New York Times. She had a neat recipe, and I kind of mixed it up a bit, changed it up a bit to make it the Eric recipe. But it's I got to credit her for that. But all of a sudden, I'm seeing butternut squash and chili in a couple of different places, and I'm wondering if everyone saw her post and then was like, oh, I'll do that.
Maybe so. I tell you, this has been just a wonderful fall garden for me, though. Lots and lots of greens, chard, cabbage, just, you know, just everything. We are eating more greens now than we've ever eaten in our lives.
I still have kale growing in my garden, and usually by now there's a foot of snow.
Yeah, yeah.
We must have got an inch of rain yesterday or more, and that should have been a foot of snow, you know?
I hope it, we need it to get, we need a good, at least one good hard freeze, just to take care of some of the pest problems and fleas and whatnot. But I'm really worried that I'm beginning to see here, trees bloom out and sap's beginning to rise.
Yep.
And if that happens and we get a good hard freeze that lasts a couple of days, we're going to have limbs down everywhere.
Yeah, I'm a little concerned about the maple syrup season. So I got to talk to my friend Bill, who is my maple syrup guru, about what we're going to do this year. Because I'm getting ready to, I'm looking at the trees I'm going to tap and figure out where I'm going to put the barrels and everything. And I'm like, I wonder if we're going to even have a season. So we'll have to see what happens there.
Yeah.
Well, neat. Well,
okay. Oh, I wanted to tell you, I am thrilled to have heard the camera operator on the other day.
Oh, yeah. That was fun, wasn't it?
You guys did a great job. Tell her she is, she's hired. She's great.
I'm actually hired by her. So I'm,
the house husband. You're here on her good wishes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I understand. That's kind of the way it is here. You know, March 1st, we'll be coming up on 40 years of marriage.
Wow.
Yeah. I didn't think it was possible. I didn't think she'd put up with me that long.
Well, there must be some redeeming quality you have. We'll have to figure out what that is.
But I can't imagine. Well, I need to get to the pool. One of my New Year's things, I don't do resolutions, but I am creating New Year's habits. And one of them is more swimming.
Excellent.
And I'm swimming 3 times a week now. And I take my very old iPhone 4S, maybe it is. And
that's my current phone, by the way.
Oh, is it? Wow. And I've converted it to really just an iPod player. And I have it's a company called Lewis and Clark. They make devices mostly for the river raft trade. And I can put the iPhone in it. It has plugs, waterproof plugs for headsets, and I listen to books while I swim.
Wow.
And so it takes the tedium out of it, which mostly what I dislike about it. And it's really good for my back. And so I've been having some sciatic problems. And so it's really good for my back, and I stay at it longer if there's something occupying my mind.
Oh, cool.
So, but it's working like a champ. And then this little thing, if it drowns on me, it's served its purpose a long time ago.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, I need to get on down the road then, my friend.
All right. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Okay. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Garden Fork's theme music is used under license from UniqueTracks.com.